Welcome. My name is Peter Reiling with the Aspen Institute. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this morning's session called Managing Global Economic Integration, What Matters, Who Decides. This session is one of several on a track that we're calling Global Dynamics. It is sponsored by Booz Allen Hamilton, and we are very grateful to them for their longtime sponsorship here at the Aspen Institute. My role is simply to welcome you. I'm going to turn things over to Bill Thoet, who is our moderator for today's panel. Some of you may remember that 2 years ago at First Ideas Fest, we had a fascinating simulation exercise, imagining we were the government of India dealing with HIV/AIDS. This is the sort of work that Bill is involved in. He spent 17 years at Booz Allen. He works on modeling, simulation, wargaming, and the like, and applying it to some of the greatest challenges of our times. And so, Bill, thank you very much. And to the panel, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much. For those of you who have been walking around the Aspen Institute the last few days, I think you'll see that this panel discussion on managing global economic integration has been a topic that's come up in many different sessions. And the key thing we're going to focus on is what matters, who decides, and I think that's been a big issue in the past about U.S. and Western domination about a lot of the decision-making in here. I'd like to introduce a very distinguished panel. I'm very pleased to be able to work with them on this. Clive Crook is a senior editor for the Atlantic Monthly. He writes a column for the National Journal. He's a commentator for the Financial Times and serves as a chief editorial advisor to David Bradley, chairman of the Atlantic Media Group. He spent 5 years as a consultant to the World Bank and worked as economist and ministerial speechwriter for Her Majesty's Treasury Department. Bill Easterly, Professor Easterly, is a professor of economics at New York University and the co-director of NYU's Development Research Institute. He spent 16 years as a research economist at the World Bank. He's also the author of two books that explore the impact of aid on the Third World, The White Man's Burden, How the West's Effort to Aid the Rest Have Done So Much Ill and So Little Good, and The Elusive Quest for Growth, Economists' Adventures and Misadventures in the Tropics. Currently, Professor Easterly is a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institute. Barry Lynn, at the end, is a senior fellow at the New American Foundation in Washington, D.C. His work focuses on how corporate power affects relations among nations and welfare of individual citizens. His first book, End of the Line, The Rise and Coming Fall of the Global Corporation, provides a look at the political and economic perils posed by how we have organized global production. And finally, Shashi Tharoor is a chairman of the Dubai-based Afras Ventures. He worked for the United Nations from 1978 to February of this year, finishing his UN career as Undersecretary General for Communications and Public Information and Senior Advisor to the Secretary General. He's a columnist for The Hindu and The Times of India and has published 9 books, both fiction and nonfiction. So welcome. Just as a little bit of an introduction to the topic, the global economy has become very complex and much more integrated due to many changes in technology and changes in the world over the last 15 to 20 years. The advent of electronic commerce and global competitive pressures have created a much more integrated and intertwined set of economies across the world. There are several institutions that were developed after World War II that were put in place with the anticipation of a broader global economy developing, but largely put together by the powers that won World War II and arranged and led by them. A lot of those have expanded. The examples are the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the World Trade Organization, which now has over 150 members. The domination of mostly Western nations in the G8 has started to recognize the importance of adding some of the key developing economies of China, India, Brazil, South Africa, and Mexico, terming it G8 plus 5 recently. Many of those nations actually may surpass many of the G8 nations in purchasing power in the next decade, with China projected to even surpass the purchasing power of the United States, maybe by 2011. So the question is, are the institutions, including the G8, the WTO, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, positioned to address the complexities of the global economy going forward? And do they have the right stakeholders represented going into the future? And is it these organizations or something else, such as multinational corporations, consumer demand, that truly drives global economic decisions? Bill?
Well, I think it's very clear now after the last 20 years that have seen the rise of China and India and the very disappointing growth in Africa and Latin America, that the old model of the IMF and the World Bank telling countries what to do and having the sort of experts fly in and stay at the local luxury hotel and, you know, tell the government how to set up free trade and free markets and free capital movements, that model is just completely obsolete and broken. It's broken beyond repair. In fact, it's, if anything, created a very harmful backlash in that it's facilitated the rise of xenophobic populists like Robert Mugabe and Hugo Chavez, people who I think are deeply, deeply misguided in their approach to economics, but have been made possible by the backlash against these, you know, powers from abroad telling other countries what to do. It's the worst possible way to spread the ideals of free trade and free markets, which are ideals that I personally deeply believe in and I think are great ideas to get out of poverty. But the worst possible way to spread them is for foreigners to tell you what to do and, you know. I think the IMF and the World Bank are managing the sound system today, so.
Yeah, that's enough of that.
That's the backlash. That's the worst possible way to spread these ideals, because then these ideals become associated with foreigners telling you what to do, and nobody likes that. You know, Americans wouldn't like Canadians.
That's what's called feedback.
This is the feedback that we're getting from the sound system. Americans wouldn't. No, my cell phone is off.
All right.
I turned it off so my ex-wife wouldn't be able to call me. Have I gotten the point across now? Or should I keep trying to battle the sound system? let's forget the IMF and the World Bank trying to devise other countries' expert plans to achieve the free market. Those countries will find their way on their own, and they are already doing so, thank God.
I mean, I remember, Bill, of another panel that we had yesterday making the point that one of the most damaging things I saw in Asia at the cusp of the millennium was this classic photograph of the poor president of Indonesia sitting down to sign an agreement with the IMF and the then director general of the IMF, Michel Condesou, looming over him, arms folded across, in a sort of just almost as if this was the big white man dictating to the Asian president what to do. And that sort of thing has terrible sort of psychological and emotional consequences. So Bill is absolutely right that there is a tremendous amount of resistance to this notion. And indeed, countries like India and China, which have by and large written their own rules and ignored those of the rules that others have tried to impose upon them that they felt didn't suit them, are the countries that have done well. So that the overall case for a set of international rules, whether you call them Washington Consensus, or you call them World Bank prescriptions or IMF guidelines or whatever, the case for that is certainly not very strong. Having said that, there is one other institution that you didn't mention in your very cogent introduction about international institutions.
Let me guess which one it is.
Exactly, my old forum, the United Nations, where of course they have no resources. The World Bank and the IMF and the WTO are where you need to go for that. But the UN is the place where every country in the world that feels it doesn't have a voice in those forums gets a chance to express its views and concerns about development policy. And so the agenda-setting function of the UN shouldn't be overlooked in this process, because one of the useful things that has come out of these deliberations has been, for example, the notion of sustainable development, which really came out of an extensive UN process but brought all 192 countries along with it, and the sense, therefore, that when you have prescriptions on global governance and so on, that you have a place in the UN where you can take the temperature as to what can actually pass muster with all of these countries. So that is to some degree, not to go away from my agreement with Bill, but to some degree to point out there are international forums where the outcomes are not purely seen as prescriptive, but where the outcomes are a result of a participatory process in which those who don't have a significant vote, where financial weighted voting prevails, like the World Bank, have a voice and a singular vote in this UN forum.
Okay. Clark?
Well, we're in danger of having too much agreement here. I'll have to try and see what I can do about this. I do agree with what both Bill and Shashi have just said about the specifics of, you know, the drawbacks of this IMF approach to dealing with countries that come to it in financial distress. But I would want to say that's not that's not what most people have in mind when they talk about managing global integration. Those particular IMF operations are about rescuing countries in acute financial distress. They aren't so much about imposing any set of global rules on the world. There aren't really any institutions for global economic management or management of economic integration. That's not what the World Bank is for. That's not what the IMF is for in its current form, at any rate. If the IMF were taking an active role in exchange rate surveillance, you could make a case for saying the IMF did have a responsibility in terms of global managing global integration, but that function of the IMF is in abeyance, and that isn't how it's conducted itself lately. As for the WTO, the WTO doesn't manage anything. The WTO is just a forum where national governments come together and make agreements. There's no executive arm of the WTO which is managing the world economy. Now, the question is, do we need an institution that is capable of managing economic integration in that sense? Do we need some kind of hybrid WTO, IMF, and World Bank, which you might think of as a kind of, even as an embryonic global economic government to manage this process of economic integration? And my answer to that would be no. I think that would be a terrible idea. But I think a lot of people who argue that the growth of MNCs, you know, that the growth of multinational corporations and the ever-onward march of globalization is undermining the power of sovereign nations and creating a vacuum that needs to be filled by some such entity. I disagree with those people. I think that is a bad idea and a misunderstanding of what's going on. My main point on this, and I won't say much more, we'll have a discussion about it, I hope, but my main point on this would be that global integration doesn't really need to be managed. It's driven by technology, largely. There is a case for an international cooperative effort to promote free trade, which is what the WTO exists to facilitate. But the interesting thing to me about the WTO is that I think it's actually foundering because it's tried to do too much. It might have been better if it had concentrated on its core mission of liberalizing trade in goods and services instead of moving more and more behind the border and giving governments a locus to tell other governments how to run their economies. And I think that process is running into the sand. You could say that, in other words, that's too much ambition in global economic management. We should be asking ourselves, what would happen if we didn't have a WTO, if we didn't have a World Bank, and we didn't have an IMF? And my answer would be, I'm not sure we'd be that much worse off. And you could make a case for saying we'd be better off.
Well, I'm going to start off by agreeing with all three of my predecessors on virtually every point.
I did try.
Yeah. But then I am going to do something to change the dynamic, perhaps. You know, it's absolutely the present model of development is broken. We need to move beyond it. But I'm going to put something else on the table, and it's going to, you know, what we're tending to look at here is economic integration. The backbone of economic integration is industrial integration. And this is something that people haven't looked at very clearly in a long time in this country, and we're missing something that has changed our world in a very profound way. And I'm going to start off, I guess, one way to illustrate this is to go back to 1951. And there was something that happened in Europe at that point. There was an agreement. It was called the Coal and Steel Agreement. And basically the agreement was to bring together, it was France and Germany, most importantly, also Italy and Belgium, and a couple of other smaller nations, Holland. They agreed to basically pool their steel industry and to some degree their coal resources. Now, the point of this was to make it far less possible for one of these nations, Germany especially, to rearm unilaterally without the others being able to shut them down by shutting down the creation, the manufacture of steel. That process is the seed out of which grew the European Union. It was a process that was, to a very large extent, promoted by the United States. It actually, the seed of the coal and steel agreement goes back to 1947, the beginning of when you had the beginning of the Marshall Plan. And when we started to pump all this money into Europe, we said, we don't want to build up national industrial systems. We don't want to have a German national industrial system, a French national industrial system, an Italian national industrial system. It would be much more efficient if we integrate these. If we have, so we don't have to replicate everything every place. So over the course of the 60 years since 1947, you've seen this growth towards what Europe is now, which is this, somewhat unified system. And there's still great tensions if you look at what's going on with Airbus right now, the fights over who gets what, who does what. 1993, the Clinton administration came to power in this country. 1994, they signed the Uruguay Round of GATT. WTO was, sort of took effect early 95. Essentially, what happened at that point is we took off all government control over the management of trade. We outsourced management of trade to the private sector. Since that moment, the U.S. economy, U.S. industrial system, has been merged with that of China, with Korea, Taiwan, Japan, to a degree that's actually more extreme than what now exists in Europe. We have done this, or this has been done, without any of the parallel sort of political arrangements that have allowed the European model to function and function well. This is a truly revolutionary event. Just to give you a sense of, put this into other perspective. During the Second World War, the United States spent about a third of our investment in the war effort went to strategic bombing. The idea was that rather than throwing men into the line, we would send airplanes over and take out the factories of the opponent. We went after ball bearing plants, oil plants, petroleum plants. What we have now done, just to compare this, we have taken our ball bearing plants, and they now are in China. So right now we're in a situation in which the dynamics of interaction among these nations is vastly different than it's ever been before. Now, this does not mean that there's not going to be conflict. But anyway, so what we have now is a situation in which we need to sort of wake up to what true industrial integration means. And just, actually to make another connection, a recent connection, if anyone's been paying attention to the pet food crisis, we had this poison that went out in the pet food system. One of the things the reporters who've been looking at that, now they're getting into the toothpaste, or looking at pharmaceuticals. One of the things that has been now revealed to us, we're not just talking about electronics that are sort of sourced. We're sourcing all these key electronics, keystone components out of Asia. We're also sourcing 80 to 100% of keystone industrial food ingredients. Things like almost all of our vitamins, vitamin C, ascorbic acid, which is it's a vital preservative, wheat gluten. 80% of the chemicals for our pharmaceuticals. So we're in a situation in which if anything goes wrong in any of these nations, it's not just physical things like food components and industrial components, it's also information, South India. If South India ever goes offline, so much of the information that is processed for us here, Citibank, GE, that is processed for those corporations, to keep those corporations moving, to keep our money, putting it at our fingertips. If that country ever goes offline, our money disappears. The back office of GE disappears. So what we have is a situation in which we are too tightly bound industrially with these nations. We have no choice, if you actually step back and look at the type of integration we've pursued so far, or the private sector has pursued for us. We have no choice but to change the structure of this system that has been created. And in the process, this is going to link it back, and in the process of changing this global system that we've created, we're going to create many opportunities, I believe, for many of the nations that have been somewhat kept out of that have not really benefited that well from this round of globalization. Because one of the things is we don't have to bring all things home. We don't need to provide all of our own wheat gluten for ourselves. We don't need to provide all of our semiconductor chips. But we can't have 75% of DRAMs coming out of South Korea. That's not a healthy situation. We should have some coming out of Brazil. We should have some coming out of, maybe there should be a plant in Egypt. Maybe more should be in India. So we need another round of globalization. We need to spread things out much more than they're spread. And that's going to actually create, the goal would be creating a much more resilient system. And in the process, you're going to be able, the opportunity will be there to integrate many more nations.
Thank you. You pointed out, Barry, some of the issues around, or at least hinted at, this dependence and the potential of creating an unstable situation and dependence between two nations, which is both good and potentially destabilizing, depending on political events. Does global integration necessarily lead to increased prosperity and stability? Are there cases where it leads to fragility and increased reaction to shocks that might happen around the world?
I mean, there's actually a number of models you can look at that show that, the system that we have built is much more subject to shock. Basically, the most important model that you could look at, there's a quake in 1999 in Taiwan. Within 3-4 days of that quake, all these factories in the United States shut down. There was no semiconductor chips flying across the sea. Luckily, the quake didn't damage any of the factories. They had it had shut down power to the airports and ports. You managed to recreate the system quite quickly, restart it quite quickly. But clearly, what you saw right there is sort of the model of what could have been a very major industrial crash. Now, that's because there's so many things that are made only in Taiwan. So it's a totally different system than we're actually used to looking. Actually, we're not used to looking at industry as a system. We're used to looking at industry as a series of isolated processing events. But what we have done, because what we've done is, industry used to be compartmentalized within the nation state, and it used to be compartmentalized within the vertically integrated corporation. Globalization busts open the compartment of the nation state. We've also busted open the vertically integrated corporation. That's what outsourcing means. You've seen and actually that's been amplified by massive consolidation, monopolization, and system after system. So when you add these things together, you end up with a true network of activity. But we're not treating this new network the way we treat other networks. We build, humans are very good at building networks to be resilient. So we actually just, we could build a very resilient network like the way the core internet is, a resilient network the way energy system, electrical systems are ideally built to be. But we haven't done that, and we have to do that.
Can I please say something?
Ahead.
I think we have our disagreement.
Insofar
as I understand what Barry is saying, and a great deal of what he's saying I don't understand, it sounds to me as if he's calling not only for global government, but for global central planning. In my view, that's self-evidently unfeasible and highly undesirable. But I just want to focus on one particular aspect of what he said, which was the
in his first comment, which was the remark about North American economic integration and European economic integration. NAFTA is more than just a free trade area. It includes all kinds of side agreements on environmental standards and labor standards and so forth. And so it is some way from a pure free trade arrangement in the direction of the European Union. You know, the European Union is at the other extreme of coordinated national governments, pooling of sovereignty, NAFTA somewhere in the middle, and then pure free trade at the end. But what Barry said was that he compared NAFTA unfavorably with the European Union. The European Union has dealt with these problems, whatever they are, these problems that global economic integration creates so much better than NAFTA. I would disagree with that. I mean, NAFTA's economic performance, to my mind, is superior to the European Union's lately, largely because the U.S. economy has done so incredibly well in recent years. But the key thing is the very factor that Barry is focusing on, which is the need for some kind of supranational governance apparatus, is the very feature of the European Union which is failing right now. I mean, anyone who's following the news knows that there's an attempt going on in Europe to create another step towards political integration, and the citizens of Europe don't actually want this. They've rejected it in France and the Netherlands, the two countries which had hitherto been most enthusiastic for European political integration. That project is flailing. NAFTA just goes on, and the American economy doesn't seem to be suffering. Not in my view.
But Barry, before you respond, we'll be all piling in on you. Give you two more things to respond to that. One is on the question of diversification. I mean, I don't know how how efficient it would be for a private company to source its semiconductors not just from Taiwan but from six other places. It would probably not be good business practice to do that. And so you're going to find at the individual company level the same vulnerabilities that you're trying to solve at the national level. But secondly, when you speak in terms of the U.S. needing to source stuff from various places and have six dependencies rather than one and so on, that still doesn't get into the area of global economic integration, surely, because you're talking about national decisions. You're talking about the U.S. at some level telling U.S. companies not to be overly dependent on one source of supplies.
So your criticism is the exact opposite of Clive's.
Exactly. Okay. So one way or the other, tell us what this works.
Can
I offer a third criticism? Thanks, Barry, for interjecting some liveliness to this by offering yourself as a sacrificial lamb. I think we already have the robust network that you want, Barry. It's the global market. And let's take this famous recent example of the toxic Chinese chemicals as an example. This shows how the global market is a self-correcting, decentralized, robust network without any need for any central planner or global economic regulator to intervene, God forbid, because they would screw it up much worse than what happened in practice. What happened in practice is Western consumers didn't want to buy toxic toothpaste. That's the market at work. Any Western company got extremely scared about buying Chinese ingredients because they knew that consumers would not buy their products. That was the second step in the self-correction of the market. And the third step was the Chinese realized that their brand, the China brand in world export markets was very badly threatened, and they've instituted a massive crackdown on all those toxic chemical producing factories, and they're going to clean up their act. So the system has already corrected itself without any global regulator in sight. That's exactly what the global market does.
So you're agreeing more with Clive.
I'm agreeing with Clive, okay. Yes. Yes.
Well,
I always agree with Clive.
You and Clive are wrong on this one. I don't advocate any global regulators. I don't advocate any sort of new multilateral institutions. Actually, Shashi understood what I'm actually advocating is national control for the sake of the United States of the system that we rely on to make sure that it's safe for us. And there is no way that we can create an entity outside of the United States that will do for us what we need done for us. And right now, the system as it is built is not good for us. I think what I'm trying to get across is in the process of fixing it so that it works for us, We're going to be actually create other opportunities for other nations to take part in the global system. And actually, the NAFTA is very different than the WTO process. Going back to Clyde's first point, and NAFTA was kind of an on the cheap effort to recreate kind of an EU style integration in North America. The way the United States embraced the WTO idea was total laissez-faire. Just let the private enterprises decide for us. So NAFTA is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the post-NAFTA. If you look, the nature of NAFTA and the nature of WTO and the American mind is two very, very different things. Going back to the last comment about the pet food, that this is a correcting situation. This is actually not a correct. This situation did correct itself somewhat. It corrected itself over time, over the course of 6 months. If you have a sudden event, then you don't have the ability to correct. That's one of the points. You have a sudden disappearance of a supplier, then you do not have that ability to correct. And then in terms of the capitalist,
you have
system,
a new supplier up here. That's what the market does.
Well, the market is actually controlled to a large extent by very powerful corporations that don't like having new competitors enter the marketplace. And it's like we have monopoly after monopoly after monopoly, and they use their market power to prevent the rise of alternative sources. And we see this in case after case after case. The market is not there. The market is a myth. And actually, I just want to, in the free market, in this system, is a myth. And here's a case with Manu Foods, which is the company that manufactures the pet food, manufactures about 55% of all the pet food in North America. 100% of most of the wet pet food in North America comes from Manu Foods. You go to the store, you see 150 brands. They're all coming from the same company. It's all one company. And the thing about Manu Foods, it did this really bad thing. It put poison out into the system, killed a bunch of cats and dogs. And you know what? After about 2 weeks after this, there was a call among investors. And it's a Canadian company saying, "Well, is this company going to die?" And one of the stock analysts said, "No, this is a buy, because you know what? It can't die, because it's a monopoly. It's never going to go down. So you don't actually have in our system now the ability to compartmentalize risk. You don't have the ability to compartmentalize liability. You don't have the So it's like." You actually, Manu Foods can keep putting poison out there, and it would take, if the only way to get rid of Manu Foods is you're going to get rid of the pet food system, or a good portion of it.
Bill, I take it that you don't agree with that from your posture.
sorry to keep piling on, Barry, but sure, there are large corporations in the world, but the idea that they each have a stranglehold on their own market is really a myth. Any company that keeps foisting toxic products on its consumers is quickly going to find a competitor. If it's not going to be some small startup that's going to come in and take away their market, it'll be one of these other global corporations that already exist that you're afraid of as a big monopoly. They will see a big profit opportunity and say, "Hey, let's get into the pet food business. These other idiots are sending out toxic pet food. That's an easy market opportunity.
AMD. AMD, which was trying to make, has twice in recent years brought better processors to the market. You should ask them about each time they've gone from about 10% of the market up to about 25%, and then they ran into the Intel machine. And the Intel machine has squashed them down to their 10% market again.
It's because Intel does what they do so well.
Well, you should go look at the Japanese happy. Right now. The Japanese are not really that big on, they pretty much let the corporations take care of themselves. Japanese have recently sort of found Intel guilty of abuse of its power because it went in and it told all the purchasers of Intel chips, Sony and Matsushita, they said, "You know what? You can't buy AMD. Or we're going to punish you in this way or that way." And suddenly it's like Sony's purchasing of AMD chips went from about 30% of what they were purchasing down to zero. And it happened with Matsushita. They all went down to zero. That's how power is exercised in these systems.
That's
the real world. That's
With the risk of the two people between, change the subject a little bit. One of the things I notice in most of the discussions this has been a common theme across Aspen. Most of the discussions took a very Western-centric view of how does global economy help the European Union? How does it help the United States? What about the perspective from the growing nations? Shashi?
Well, I mean, obviously globalization has benefited India in extraordinary ways. There's no question that the remarkable economic growth you've seen in India since 1991 is directly a result of India's opening up to the global economy, of encouraging foreign investment, and of course of finding foreign markets. And there's no question that the wonderful sort of fears of Y2K that resulted in Indian software programmers and computer geeks suddenly finding a receptive audience for their talents in this country, the collapse of the overbuilding of fiber optic cabling, and then the stock market crash thereafter that meant fire sales of all of this. All of this helped India immensely. India would not be where it is today in relation to where it was 15 years ago were it not for the global economy, no question about that. But India doesn't, you know, there's actually somebody sitting in the audience who's better qualified to talk about this than me, but he has another panel to go to. Who's the economics columnist of the Times of India. I'm sort of more of a general thinker. But the fact is that in India today, we actually have a number of areas where we're not as open to the global economy as is popularly imagined. There are bits of our industry that are still protected. There are still high tariffs on certain kinds of imports. And we haven't fully got away from the old dogma of self-reliance, which came as a result of 200 years of being colonized by other people who came to, ostensibly anyway, to trade and then stayed on to rule, which is why embedded into the Indian sort of political DNA is a certain amount of suspicion of foreign capital. All this is changing. It takes time to change. But I wouldn't say that India has gone from being an overly protected to a completely open economy. It has large areas that are open, which have actually helped immensely growth and change in India. But there are large bits where India is less vulnerable to shocks in the global system because it's more insulated from it than other countries are.
Well, I think that brings up a good point. We've talked about some of the forces that are driving economic integration. What are the forces that inhibit it?
One obvious question is governmental policies. I mean, there are governments that everywhere, not just in the developing world, that undertake policies that are not in favor of global integration. A classic example is agricultural subsidies in Europe and in America. I mean, I suddenly did the calculation that the level of agricultural subsidies in Europe are so great that they could actually pay for every cow in Europe to fly first class around the world. I mean, that's basically the amount. Now, what this means essentially is that poor African farmers who would love to export their products to Europe have an insuperable wall to climb over. And for that matter, you can talk about American cotton subsidies and compare them to what it costs a Malian cotton farmer to grow cotton. So there are conscious government policies driven by the domestic politics of each country that make it difficult for the rest of the world to compete fairly with the entrenched economic advantages within each of these countries. And so that is a systematic problem. And going back to your larger question of global economic integration, the whole idea of economic integration would only work if it benefits everybody. If it's not just big American corporations having the right to establish themselves in any country they choose to. It also has to be poor African farmers being able to sell their products in the markets of the developed world without having to compete against extremely well-cosseted and pampered domestic farmers who've been excessively subsidized.
Well, could I just underline my agreement with what Shashi just said? You only need to look at China and India to understand that globalization helps developing countries. The view that globalization is somehow a plot to keep the poor countries down is preposterous. We're in a phase of history now where we're seeing the fastest progress in eradicating world poverty because of growth in China and India that has ever been witnessed in history. And that is not because of government policies in the rich world, it's because of globalization. So we shouldn't even be discussing that anymore. Globalization helps the poor. The miracles that are going on in China and India are because of globalization. And the obstacles to fuller global economic integration are, as Shashi says, the responsibility of governments, not just in the rich world, but there are protectionist policies all over the world, including still to some degree in China and India, and especially in Africa. Africa is the other side of the story. Africa's problem is not globalization. I very often read Africa's plight is somehow a side effect of globalization. It's the opposite.
Not enough
globalization. That is why, and it is a major challenge, a very difficult challenge, to integrate, to get Africa integrated in the world economy in a way that allows it to benefit from this process. But the basic fact to focus on is that Africa's problem is that it is not fully part of the emerging global economy. It's too little globalization is Africa's problem, not too much.
Can I just say one thing about Africa? I think I agree with Clive, but I would say that's actually starting to change. And just to reinforce Clive's point, Africa is actually starting to benefit from globalization. The commodity boom of the last few years has been thanks to the growth of China and India, and it's benefited Africa. Africa's had 3 years of 6% GDP growth in a row. It's had the last 5 years have been the highest growth in Africa's history. So Africa is starting
to... Unevenly spread, wouldn't you say?
Well, growth is always unevenly spread, but it's much better to have growth than to have zero growth,
sure.
To have no growth.
Yeah.
So, you know, I drink these days Rwandan coffee every day. Someone tipped me off that the best coffee in the world is Rwandan coffee. You know, there's all kinds of African products out there that are waiting to be discovered by Western consumers.
Hmm. Well, Clive, you made a comment earlier about that the market will organize itself globally. We've just heard that a lot of the nation states are creating rules that provide barriers to that. Isn't that really what the organizations, the international organizations, should be addressing? How do you lower those barriers? That's what they were originally put in place for. Are they doing the job? And is it being driven by Western interests or is it being driven by world interests?
Well, it's a subtle question. It's a subtle issue. If you think of what the WTO and before it the GATT, the GATT, were intended to do, the way to think of them is that these were really disarmament treaties. The economic logic of trade is that it is in the interest of the country lowering its trade barriers to do so. So you shouldn't need a GATT. You shouldn't need a WTO. There should be spontaneous, unilateral trade liberalization because it is in every country's own interest to lower its own trade barriers. Now, the logic behind the GATT and the WTO was that was politically a difficult thing to sell to domestic electorates. People are reluctant to believe that free trade is in their own interests. And so the way to move this process forward was to have governments in the interests, you know, with the objective lowering of their own trade barriers, to extract so-called concessions from other governments, and then they could take that to their own electorates and say, see, we have something in return for lowering our own trade barriers. But do you understand what I'm saying? The economic logic behind that was flawed. This was a political calculation. So the way to judge the WTO is whether it is facilitating this process of trade disarmament or retarding it. I think there is now a reasonable case to be made for saying that it is slowing the process rather than speeding it up. When you look at the outcome we don't really have an outcome. If you look at the Doha round, you know, the current round of trade negotiations, I think what has happened is that governments have become locked into their own rhetoric, and you see many governments saying, well, we aren't going to liberalize unless you do. That completely perverts the economic logic that was supposed to underpin this process. You have governments in the third world saying, unless the rich world does more to open its markets, which, as I insist, the rich countries should do in their own interests. But you have Brazil saying, unless you do this, we won't liberalize. This is crazy. I actually think now we're moving to a point where what you might want to say is just hold up the examples of countries that have liberalized unilaterally and say, look, it's worked for them. We should be doing the same thing.
Well, I think you're pointing out that a lot of the process, it's supposed to be an economic process, but it's largely a political process.
Well, there are always going to be complaints of unfairness. I mean, the subsidies are a classic example. You say, all right, we'll liberalize, and you can export, and we can export, and so on. But there's the fact of, you know, who's getting what hidden benefits before they price the products they're exporting. And these political charges of unfairness are going to have to be dealt with politically within domestic political systems.
I think there's actually following on Clive's comment. I mean, if you look at the countries that did unilaterally open themselves, liberalize, you look at the first generation of countries that really do that. Most of them were in Latin America, and I was actually working in Latin America. Some of you heard this yesterday. But I was working in Latin America at the time. I was in Bolivia in 86, which is, you know, when Jeffrey Sachs was perfecting his experiments. And I was in living in Venezuela in 89 when there was a IMF, a modified IMF shock that led to these incredible riots that led sort of rather directly to the Chavez moment. I was in Peru living in 1990 when President Fujimori imposed the Fuji shock. And you know, I spent a lot of time in Chile, you know, in Ecuador and Mexico. And, you know, the countries that followed the rules, that opened themselves most completely, are the countries that are now where you're seeing the greatest reaction. You know, Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador. We almost saw a reaction in Mexico. And, you know, I think that this idea that just opening yourselves up to market forces is, you know, is the pathway to salvation is bunk, because it's not market forces. It's very powerful companies that tend to come in and often extract wealth. Or it's actually often, you know, or it's people that in your own nation who happen to sort of take advantage of the newly free, you know, the fact that the border is much more open to move wealth and themselves abroad. So, and the countries over in the 1990s, you know, the ones that have been the big successes are, you know, they're often really big countries. China is a success because it doesn't play those games. China is an extremely interventionist, has an extremely interventionist government. It runs its economy to certain ends. It has strategy, it has long-term strategy, and it pursues those strategies. And it's doing very well by pursuing those strategies. India less so. It doesn't, you know, it's a less, you know, strategic approach. But, you know, with Malaysia, even going back to Latin America, the country that's done best is the country that's played the least. Chile, it went Chicago school at the beginning, and then it went interventionist soon thereafter, and it did very quite well. If you look at the monetary, you know, if you look at how they managed monetary,
Chile is an instance of dirigism in Latin America. That's the first time I've heard that. But listen, I do want to agree with part of what Barry's saying. I think this goes back to something that Bill said at the beginning. I think it is a mistake to impose a prescription on a country. I mean, above all, on a democracy. And although I think that unilateral liberalization is the way to foster development, I understand that not everybody agrees with that. And I think you actually doom that policy to failure if you force it on a country unwillingly and the government is then able to disown it. Yeah. And this is the Latin American paradigm. Yeah. We aren't doing this because we believe in it. We're doing it because these guys in the IMF have forced us to. That is bad. And I'm afraid, even though I believe Latin American-style dirigism has been a catastrophe, if democracies want to pursue that route, if governments are unable to take their electorates with them, then they should not do it. That would be my view. And I think this is the point that Bill was making at the beginning. It's a mistake to force liberalization on a country that doesn't want it. But having said that, I do maintain, and I would suggest, that there is a pretty firm consensus among economists on this, that liberalization with respect to trade, integration with the global market, is the key to rapid development, and the unilateral liberalizers are the ones that have shown that that is true.
We've talked a lot about nation states and their role in making the decisions. What are the roles, or what should be the roles, of individuals that are affected, as you just mentioned, global corporations and collective communities in gaining the greater integration? How do they get a seat at the table, or should they?
Well, they're the ones who are integrating right now. I mean, throughout this conversation, we've been talking about companies making decisions about where to source their products and hire people that can do what they need done and find markets they can go to. So companies are actually functioning on a global scale ahead of governments. I think it's not that they're looking for a seat at the table. It seems to me more that governments, through policies, can prevent companies from doing more.
I think that's my point. In the organizations that are driving the rules, do the corporations and the individuals who benefit have enough say in which direction to lower some of those barriers and things that you all acknowledge would be beneficial for all?
Bill?
I feel that it would be a terrible error to give companies a seat at the table. That is absolutely not what I, you know, as a sort of defender and enthusiast of free enterprise, that is certainly not what I would be calling for. It isn't the job of companies to be making economic policy. I think that's a very dangerous suggestion. I resist, actually, the notion of applying this kind of stakeholder concept to global economic governance. No. Let the market make the economic coordination decisions, and then let national governments regulate the outcomes in the interests democratically determined of their own electorates. And I think this is what Bill was saying at the beginning. If America wants to regulate chemicals or, you know, pet food in certain ways, America is perfectly within the competence of the American government to do that. Globalization does not undermine that power of initiative. We can have an argument about what kind of regulation makes sense, but globalization does not undercut, in my view, that authority. And absolutely not. No, don't give global companies a say in those political decisions. Those are decisions to be made by governments who are democratically accountable to voters.
Yeah, that's actually, couldn't have been said better. The only problem is it doesn't really jibe with the reality of the world today, which is that the private sector corporations are making the decisions now. They are determining who trades what where. They are determining the global division of labor. You know, I mean, Walmart is, you know, well, 50% of general merchandise in the United States sells through Walmart. Walmart has control to a very large degree over its suppliers in the United States and abroad. You know, Walmart will go in and basically, if it doesn't like the pricing here, it will help companies shift the production abroad. You know, and those companies have no choice unless they want to give up that 50% market share. So, I mean, what you have a situation in which, I mean, just looking again at Walmart, Walmart in many ways is the reincarnation of the East India Company, the British East India Company.
They don't have an army yet.
They don't have an army yet. Well, the only problem is that they, you know, in terms of for us, is that we kind of got the wrong end of the British East India Company on ourselves. Walmart, in some ways, is the export arm of the Chinese state. Walmart is using its power to suppress production here in the United States as the British East India Company suppressed production in India. That's the reality today. That's how power is exercised. It would be nice to get back to a situation in which you had a functioning market.
You have to be careful about using words like determine and power in these contexts. When one says the market determines an outcome, it's a spontaneous result, and it reflects a sort of a competition among different companies, a vast diversity of consumer interests, what people want, what people are willing to pay for what they want. All through this process of competition, yes, an outcome is determined. But that is not to say that the CEO of Walmart is sitting in his office with a giant input-output matrix planning the world economy. Walmart thrives because it meets the demands of consumers. It's driving down prices, and that is what consumers want. When they fail to do that, they will be out of business.
Walmart is actually, I mean, the important thing you said there is it is not planning the system. And that's actually true. It's not planning the system. So what we've actually managed to do is we've actually recreated a system that looks a whole lot like the Soviet system, but without the planning. So.
I'm going to take questions from the audience. Sue?
I'm not sure if this is on, but...
It is.
I find this a very interesting conversation. I really appreciate being able to sit here and listen. It seems to me that it is somewhat untethered to reality with regard to how corporations actually work. And I would submit that the much maligned Sarbanes-Oxley requirements actually have reinforced what good management in corporations. I'm associated with one large global company and several other not-so-large companies, require very active risk assessment and management and projection of what risks may be in the future, and the company who has found itself, you know, working with a monopoly supplier that is supplying it with bad product is in serious trouble. And the self-correcting mechanisms inside the corporation, I believe, should be working to enable that company to immediately go out and try to find a diversity of sources of supply, which are exactly what Barry wants, I believe, the world to end up with. I was actually quite struck by the beginning of Barry's comments because they sounded a lot like what we have been talking about for years with regard to the infrastructure within this country in terms of becoming more resilient and less dependent on single sources of supply. I think that's a very good thing to be reminded of. But I do think there are mechanisms in place that will make that happen if they are adequately used.
Barry, you had some comments on this earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I agree absolutely. And I mean, the thing is that one of the factors that I didn't really touch on in terms of the mixture of changes that have really revolutionized the industrial system is the Toyota model, Toyota production system. Toyota system, you may heard about it as lean production or just in time. The Toyota system, Toyota actually internally calls it the fragile system. One of the reasons it's called fragile production is because it relies on single sources. And the reason that Toyota began to rely on single sources is back in the 50s was because they were competing with really big companies across the sea, General Motors and Ford, which were able to always rely on 3, 4, 5 outside suppliers. You had massive amounts of inventory. You would keep the lines going because you had all this waste and you could afford the waste. So as you applied Toyota's system to production, you've sort of stripped out the inventory throughout the system and you stripped out the supply base. And you're absolutely right. Firms will always seek, you never want to be held up, so you'll always seek to have at least two suppliers. But there's a very big difference between real-time alternative supply and contract time. You know, and the thing is that, you know, real-time means that you could, you know, this guy goes down, you could turn the spigot here and you got the same thing. Contract time means that, okay, this guy starts to screw you over, you're going to shift next year's contract to this guy. So what we have now is everyone is dual-sourced. But it's in contract time. None of it's very little of it's real time anymore. So and just, you know, just so you know, like, I'm a reporter, and all of what I said in the book that I wrote, all of this is just I went around and talked to industrialists, and I gathered their stories together. And there's a lot of industrialists who are really deeply scared about what they have done to the system, and they don't know how to get that message to the people who actually regulate the system. And the system is regulated. I mean, it's regulated by old. It's either you regulate with new rules, you regulate with old rules. Most of them are bad rules, but that's what you know. It's.
And can I want to build? Yes.
Bill, I don't want to cut you off.
Well, I'm getting a lot of this sounds to me like the talk that I've been hearing for years and years about sort of the global corporate World Bank IMF conspiracy to, you know, regulate to rig all the rules of the world economy in favor of corporations. And, you know, I don't have a lot of direct evidence, just that I've met a lot of World Bank managers, a lot of corporate managers, and, you know, frankly, these guys aren't smart enough to do a global conspiracy. No offense to anyone in the room. And they have such widely divergent interests, as Clive pointed out, that there's no possibility that they could do some kind of collective conspiracy to rig the world in their interest.
But no one's saying it's a conspiracy.
Let's keep in mind something. You know those business books that come out every year about the 10 most successful companies and here are their secrets to success? Have you ever noticed that the 10 companies are always different every year? You know that, and that the one that was described as being the paragon of success for everyone to imitate last year, this year is, you know, way down in the stock market and everyone is fleeing it in droves. These corporations are at the mercy of investors and consumers. They're not the all-powerful Goliath that you're making them out to be, Barry.
I mean, there's no one is saying that there's a conspiracy here. There is no conspiracy. There's no planning. And to some extent, the entire lack of strategic approach to the system is one of the problems, is that no one's looking to see how it's structured. And, you know, the thing about the industrialists, the CEOs, the VPs, the people who are my heroes, the people who I have worked with are the VPs of engineering, the VPs of supply chain, the VPs of manufacturing. I mean, these are men and women who are doing incredible jobs to move stuff around the world, to get it here, to put it on the shelves, put it on your plates. And these people are struggling against immense odds, and they're the ones who are really scared.
And it's like, I want to say a quick comment, and then we'll take another question.
This relates to the question as it was originally posed. Companies have every incentive to manage these risks, or they already have every incentive to manage these risks, to optimize them in some sense, and strike the appropriate trade-offs. And there will be competition among companies to do that in the most intelligent way. I'll give you a specific instance. I work in the magazine business. The magazines have to be printed. And if you're on a time-critical schedule and the print works goes down, you're stranded. So you make contingency plans, and you write contracts with other printers. So if your main printer goes down, you can use another printer instead. And those contracts cost you money, so you have to strike a balance about how much safety you build into the system as opposed to how much you're willing to spend to provide that safety. And different magazines will take a more conservative view on that, spending more for more protection, than others who will take the chance. And that decision, in turn, will depend on the competitive environment those magazines are in. In other words, what's the problem? Companies are aware of this issue, and they will address it to the optimal extent according to their own individual circumstances. Are we really to suppose that a government can make those decisions for all these companies, make one decision, this is how it will be, and that system will be superior to what we have now?
Government,
I find the notion absurd.
Government doesn't have to make any micromanaging decisions. Government has to set very basic principles that would allow the people who are actors in this economy to make wise decisions. It would free them to make wise decisions. Right now, Dell Computer is running at the edge all the time. They grew very rapidly by running at the absolute edge. Now, what happens to all the companies that were competing with Dell? Well, I mean, IBM PC, Compaq PC, a lot of these companies no longer exist. HP finally figured out how to compete with Dell by doing the exact same thing that Dell does, which is to some extent run at the absolute edge. So they were actually, the way that competition played out was a race to the most fragile situation. That's how the competitive environment, that's the result of the present competitive environment.
So they should be forbidden to do that.
How the government would do it? I mean, if you just actually require firms to dual source two places, you don't tell them where.
Well, I think you're basically saying that right now firms self-insure by making those decisions, mm-hmm. and right now the reason the government might get involved in it is if that insurance is too low, the government eventually is going to, or the country is going to pay. Let's take another question.
Okay, I'll just start with one comment. If it is really true that Walmart is becoming an arm of the Chinese state, clearly the great corporation is no longer dominating the world. governments are taking over. I mean, you can't really have it both ways. Let me add that clearly it's not a Chinese state enterprise, because Walmart is so worried about its overdependence on China. It is coming to second-rate companies in India that cannot compete with China, but nevertheless contracting with them in order to reduce its dependence upon China. It does not require any instructions from the United States government to do that. I'm sorry, okay, that's just besides. But the larger issue of global integration, actually, I was rather disappointed. You talk a lot about this trade, but there is also the global integration of labor and the global integration of capital, which I found was missed completely and totally, both of which, it seems to me, are becoming far more important. On the one hand, there was the Asian financial crisis, which still dominates psychology. So there is the downside of global integration on capital. The plus side is there can be a penniless Indian called Lakshmi Mittal, whom global markets can finance to become the biggest steel company owner in the whole world. He could never have done it with his own money. He could only do it through the global integration of financial market. So you have both those particular sides of it. And it seems to me that if the net result of this is that you will get third world multinationals increasingly coming up to counter the Western multinationals, some of the fears of David Manning need to be reworked. Then we come to the issue of global integration of labor, the migration, which becomes all important. It seems to me ultimately On the one hand, as we heard from Ayan Hirsi Ali yesterday, I mean, there are a huge series of problems caused by this migration of labor. And yet, ultimately, if you're going to end war, I mean, if there's this idea that an integrated world does not go to war, it seems to me that labor migration has to become part of it.
I agree completely with that. Yeah. I think that it is striking that, you know, we have free trade, free movement of capital, pulse of a button, you can send billions of dollars around, but an individual has to wait months and months for a visa if he ever gets one to go someplace. And particularly for developing countries, the one big advantage they have is surplus labor. And it's striking that countries in Europe, and for that matter Japan, which are desperately short of labor, still place such high barriers towards people coming in and doing the work that their own nationals are not able to do. So I think it's a point we should have taken into account.
He's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and I think especially in India, where you actually can bring labor electronically to the rest of the world in certain services, that has been a very large growth source.
Yeah, but you can't outsource Asia. Your gardening, you can't outsource your snow shoveling, you can't, you know, and those are things right now in this country that have created a different kind of political problem with immigrants coming in illegally to fulfill a real need.
Right.
But there are other places in the world where it's not that easy to come in illegally. I mean, you can't get into Japan, for God's sake, you know, illegally the way you can across the Mexican border into the U.S. Mm. And there are sort of real issues there that the world is politically not ready to grapple with.
Mm. Another question.
I'm just finishing The White Man's Burden, and while I hoped you were wrong, I fear you're right. going back to the World Bank and the IMF, is it the call to completely shut them down, or in your words, switch from planning to searchers who are you know, basically running it better? Or just can it not be run better? And the second question is, my fear is...
You have to finish the book.
What's that?
You have to finish reading the book.
The last page, I guess. The second one is that the economic does assume that there's rationality brought to the leaders, and my fear is, especially in Africa, where the poorest people are, that the leadership is not economically rational. And so is it better for others to get involved and try to rationalize what their decision-making should be, or is it something too Pollyanna, we should just stay away and... It's just one of the sad cases that we have to deal with at the time in many countries of the continent.
I don't think that you can fix sort of what the West might view as an irrational ruler from the outside. That just doesn't work. We have a horrific track record doing that all around the world, Iraq being the most obvious current one. And the history of Western intervention in Africa has just bred enormous resentment and made possible even more bad government, if anything. I think you, by trying to intervene, you actually make bad rulers more likely rather than make them less likely. You know, the hopeful thing in Africa is that democracy is spreading, that citizens groups are becoming much more vocal, that free press is becoming much more effective in Africa. And so Africans are fixing their own problems by holding their own governments accountable. You know, they seem, there are plenty of African rulers that these days seem, frankly, a little bit more accountable than Dick Cheney.
I think we have time for one more question.
Wouldn't be hard, would it?
Hi. My question is that it was sort of suggested earlier that poverty is being eradicated at a greater rate than sort of ever before, but... sort of the disparity between the rich and the poor seems to be getting greater, and sort of by all means, the poor seem to be getting poorer and the rich seem to be getting richer. And I think a lot of that has to do with, to me, it always seems like, I'm not an economist, but it always seems like the conversation is twofold. On the one hand, you have one conversation about how GDPs are improving all around the world and you're improving wealth in terms of greater country wealth, but you're not really looking at sort of the improvement of standard of living of the people you're actually trying to affect with these free trade policies. And so I guess my question is sort of, how do you bridge those two conversations, one between the growing rich-poor barrier and the GDP conversation? Because it seems like this conversation was largely about GDPs, but, you know, that redistribution of resources that free trade really sort of champions never seems to happen. And, you know, again, the poor just seem to be getting poorer.
The poor aren't, in fact, getting poorer. This is the most important thing that people should understand about globalization. I hear this all the time. It's just plainly false. India and China are growing incredibly rapidly, and the poor in those countries are seeing rising incomes. Rural incomes in China, the poor part of China, are rising at nearly 6% a year, which is faster than rural incomes in China have ever grown since the beginning of time. The poor are not getting poorer. What is happening is that inequality, country by country, around the world, in very many places, is widening. But that is not because the poor are getting poorer. The poor are making progress, but people on the highest incomes are seeing their incomes rise at much higher rates. So that's increasing inequality. Now, I do regard that as a problem. I think that is a legitimate cause for concern, and governments need to address it. But let's not muddle these two things up. Poverty is retreating globally because of globalization, and we should understand that and welcome it. Inequality needs to be addressed as a separate issue, and that is more, as I say, to do with the fact that the rich are getting richer much faster than they used to.
Yes, Shashi,
just two complementary comments. One is, the poor are getting less poor, but that's happening fairly slowly. In India, by and large, over the last 5 years, there's been enormous growth, but poverty, the percentage of the population living in poverty, below a rather low poverty line drawn in India, has been declining by about 0.8% a year. So it's, we still have 250 million people in India living below a dollar a day, and frankly, not below a dollar a day, living below the Indian poverty line, which is drawn just this side of the funeral pyre. And there's still people above the Indian poverty line who are living below a dollar a day. So there is a serious problem, and you're right to raise it. Unfortunately, it belongs to a different panel. This is a panel about global economic integration. But Clive is right. While the poor are getting less poor, the rich are getting a lot more rich. And that's where governmental policies, including tax policies, become serious issues. But they're policies not to be settled, I think, at the global level, but in terms of national political choices. Mm. I was recounting at a panel yesterday this amazing statement by Warren Buffett that he paid 17% tax last year on his vast billions, and his receptionist, who earns a zillion for what he earns, paid 30%. Now, there's something clearly wrong with the tax structure that allows that to happen. And there are national policies that can be undertaken by political leaders to ensure that these transparent inequalities are addressed, and therefore that the famous Gini coefficients are a little more narrow. I mean, India still manages to be relatively less unequal than some of the other countries. Brazil and China have actually got much worse than they were before globalization helped them to grow. So you're right to raise the question, but...
Well, thank you. I think we're near an end here. When we start talking death and taxes, it's probably time to move on. I want to thank the panel for a very interesting discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.